Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Did anyone bring their Bibles by chance? If you did, turn to Exodus chapter 17. Exodus chapter 17, starting in verse 8, it's a familiar story if you were raised in the church. I can remember as a young kid in Sunday school, and this was one of the stories that I heard as a young person. And it's actually the first introduction of Joshua into the Old Testament text. He shows up again in this is chapter 17. He shows up again, I think, in 24, and then Numbers 11, Numbers 13, and then obviously the book of Joshua. But in this story, there are four main characters. There are two armies fighting, the Amalekites and the Israelites, and then you have four main characters. And those characters are Joshua, Moses, Aaron, and Hur. And as you think about these four men, you got Joshua, you got Moses, you've got Aaron, and you've got Hur. Let me read the story for those who don't have a Bible. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands." So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side and one on the other, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the memory of the Amalekite from under heaven." Moses built the altar and called it, "The Lord is my banner." He said, "For his hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation." So in this story, you have two armies fighting, the Amalekites and the Israelites, but you have these four characters. What do we know about Joshua? What are some of the character traits that we know about Joshua? Who was he? He was a military man, right? So he was a warrior. What else? He was a disciple. You bet. He was a learner. What else? He was a servant. Yeah, he was obedient. He was a servant. What else? I'm going to call a learner, but he was a disciple for sure.
Absolutely.
He was a man of faith. In fact, it's interesting, in the scriptures we read about Moses being a servant of the Lord. He's the first person in all the Old Testament that's called a servant of the Lord. But the second person was Joshua. Joshua was a man, this guy was a military leader. He was a warrior. This is a man who was charismatic. This is a man who stood up and people followed him because of who he was. In fact, often when we think of leaders, we think of the Joshua, don't we? Decisive, visionary, charismatic, very able. He was a victor. He overcame the Amalekites. He ends up being, Moses' successor. He is what we often think of when we think about a leader. Moses. What do we know about Moses? What are some of the characteristics that we identify with Moses?
Leader.
He's certainly a leader. Yep.
Lawgiver.
A what?
Lawgiver and redeemer.
He's a lawgiver. And where did the law come from? From God. Moses was a man that God spoke. So Moses was a righteous man, right? I mean, this is a man that God spoke to. Man of faith. He believed that God was who he claimed to be. So he was a man of faith. God spoke to him. You know, oftentimes we hope that our pastors are Moses, don't we? The person who just hears God and listens to God, who carries out the work that God has called them to do. He's, again, probably the kind of person that when we think of spiritual leadership, he'd be someone who would come into our mind. What about Aaron? What do we know about Aaron?
He was a communicator.
He was a communicator, right, exactly. Yeah, he could speak well. He had the gift of communication, apparently. What else?
Priest.
He was a priest. What else? We know that he was Moses' brother. So he had access to power. To power. What else? Yeah. Whether he was a good leader or not a good leader, I'm not sure, but he did get himself in trouble a few times. Finally, what about her? Who is her? My guess is there's not a person in this room that knows who her is. Why is that? How many times is her mentioned in the Bible?
Twelve.
As far as I can tell, it's maybe only one in the story. So who is her? We don't know who her is. But I find it interesting that when we think of leadership, we think of Joshua, charismatic warrior, a servant of the Lord. But when we think of leadership, we never think of her. And the reality is that if Aaron and Hur don't hold the arms of Moses in the air, the Amalekites overcome the Israelites. When I think of Hur, you know, I probably in this room, maybe 10% of you are Joshuas. You're charismatic. You are decisive, visionary. You're men of faith or women of faith. Maybe there's even 10% of you in this room who are more spiritual leaders. Maybe you listen to God in ways that many of us cannot hear Him. Some of you are Aaron because you just happen to be born in the right place or in the right family, or you happen to be in a circumstance of all the stars align and you end up to be the head of an organization. And that happens about 10% of the time. Most of us are hers. Most of us, when we're called into leadership, it's a leadership role that is nothing more, in a sense, than doing what we're called to do. I relate to her. No one's going to write a book about my life. No one's going to care when I'm 6 feet under, my toes are pointing up in the sky. No one's going to really care other than my family. But I know that every day I need to wake up and I need to do the right thing. I need to hold the arms of Moses in the air so that the Israelites overcome the Amalekites. Most of us in leadership are hers. We do what is right. We are faithful to our spouses. We care for our children. We serve at our churches and we serve in our organizations. And we do the things that God has called us to do. And no one's going to care whether we do it or not. Except the fact that when we don't do our job, the enemy overcomes us. And most of us in leadership are hurt. We've got to wake up each day, and we've got to do the right thing. Do as God had commanded. Some of us are Joshua's, some of us are Moses, and some of us are Aaron's, but most of us are hers. But hers role in this story is no less important than Joshua's, Moses, and Aaron. Because if he doesn't do what he's called to do, the Israelites are defeated. So when I hear someone say to me, you know what, I'm just not a leader. I just don't know how to have the gift of leadership. I say, well, that may be. You may not have the spiritual gift of leadership like Joshua had, but you can always be a her. You can always do the work that God's called you to do. Yesterday I talked a little bit about how complex this whole area of leadership is. You know, there are 187 million different possible Google options of leadership. If we took 1 minute on all 187 million of those Google hits, it would take us 355 years to get through all that information. So how do you ever make any sense of this whole thing called leadership? Well, what I tried to give you yesterday is just a framework to think about leadership. It wasn't to be all-inclusive, it wasn't to be the final answer, but it was to give you a sense that if there are 187 million possibilities of understanding leadership, then if I have an outline to work from, a framework, then I can at least say, you know what, for me to be effective at the work that God's called me to do, for me to be, whether I'm her, Aaron, or Moses, or Joshua, that I can think about things like my integrity. How do I live out my faith to salt and light? How do I align my beliefs with my behavior? And I think I mentioned that passage out of 1 Timothy, where Paul says to Timothy that, you know, watch your doctrine and your practice. Because if you do, you will save not only yourself, but those who hear you. And then we talked, second of all, we talked, the second topic we talked about, what was it? Was vision. And vision is defined as a destination. What is the destination that you're trying to point to? What is the end goal? Now, it can be a little bit, it doesn't have to be as specific as to say 5 years from now I'll be doing such and such. But it's to say I need to be on a path that takes me somewhere. And that's called the destination. The third thing is communication. We know that Aaron spoke for Moses because Moses didn't have the gift of communication. But you've got to be clear in how it is that you communicate your message to those that you work with. And finally, self-awareness. You know, who are you? You know, I think I mentioned to you that my definition of adulthood is the point in which you are comfortable in your own skin. When you realize who you are as an image bearer, made in the image and likeness of God, who are you in Christ? You know, the biggest challenges we have today in our universities in the United States is a lack of identity. It's just interesting to me when I see students behaving badly. You know, I work at a Christian school, a Christian university. It's one of the predominant Christian universities in the United States. To get into it, for a student to come into Wheaton College, you have to sign a statement that you are an evangelical. And yet, again, probably in our little school, we have about 2,500 students. I'm sure every year there are probably 200 that sign that statement because they want the education but don't really believe the statement of faith that they're signing. But so those students tend to behave badly no matter, you know, where they were to go to school. But we also have another percentage of students who are evangelical. They were raised in Christian homes, and they behave badly. Why is that? Well, I think it's primarily because their identity is not in Christ. Their identity is in something else. And so what they do is that they seek other identities. The partier identity, the womanizer, the manizer. I'm not sure what the woman equivalent of that would be. But they find themselves identifying with something that is not in Christ. And so what happens is you have all kinds of behaviors which are ultimately very destructive in their lives. So that's kind of what we did yesterday. Today, what I thought we would do is talk about an area that I think is as difficult as any area in leadership and organizational development, and that is succession planning. Warren Bennis, I mentioned him yesterday. You know, Warren Bennis had this quote in a book he wrote which I have on your sheet. I'll read it, that I think is true as any statement I've read about leadership, and that is this. The long-term viability of an organization is directly related to its ability to attract and retain quality personnel. And in leadership, one of our greatest challenges is how do I pass on my experiences, my role as a leadership to another generation? It's very difficult. In fact, we live in a world today where many of our young leaders or young people do not want to assume the role of leadership. Why is that? Well, in the Czech Republic, there's a saying, the tallest blade of grass gets cut first. If you rise to some level of leadership, someone is going to come by and cut you off. So if we live in a society where leadership is not something that is valued or that is esteemed, how do we raise new leaders? How do we do that? And that's all part of planning for the future. About 7 years ago, I was really interested in this whole idea of leadership development as it relates to this next generation. And so what I did is I came over here to Central and Eastern Europe and I did a huge research project. I interviewed 30 Christian leaders, primarily in the Czech Republic and Slovak Republic, and I interviewed 30 young leaders. And what I would try to understand is how is it that leadership can be passed on from one generation to the next? And so what I've done is I've summarized that in this research project right here, and I'm going to go through some of that in this outline right here, and we'll see what leaders expect out of young leaders, maybe seasoned leaders out of young leaders, and then how the young leaders respond to being developed into leadership. So the first question I asked, I gathered together 30 leaders, much like yourself. Now, this is Central and Eastern Europe, so it didn't include Western Europe. And the question I asked them was this: what qualities or characteristics would you like to see developed in your young leaders? What are they? And after interviewing these 30 leaders, here's what they said. First of all, just to emphasize this whole idea of how difficult it is to raise up young leaders. Some of you that have had an experience under communism will appreciate this. I asked this one country leader, I said, why is it that it's so difficult to develop young people? And here's what he said. I think that most of our students now are minimally impacted by communism directly and strongly impacted by it indirectly. In other words, the effects of communism were still present in a generation that wasn't raised under the totalitarianism of that political system. So anyway, so when I ask this question, so what are some of the characteristics that you would like to see developed in your young leaders? And the first one, by far, was the first one on the outline, which is they want to see in their young leaders a servant's heart. They want to see in their young leaders the idea that leadership is not about taking control. It's not about totalitarianism. It's about serving. They wanted to see in their leaders, the young leaders, the sense that they're there to help, to shepherd, to care for, to love the people that they work with. Now, the models of leadership that we see, you know, again, oftentimes we think of Joshua, this warrior, this visionary who takes control and defeats the Amalekite army. What leaders told me was that they want someone maybe with vision, but clearly with the idea that they can serve rather than to be served. Mark chapter 10, verse 45, Jesus said, I came not to be served, but to serve and give my life as a ransom for many. It's one of the key verses, key things that Jesus said about his ministry. And this is the first characteristic that leaders in Central and Eastern Europe wanted to see developed in young leaders. The second thing was they wanted their young leaders to become self-aware. This relates back to what we talked about yesterday. They wanted young leaders had a sense of who they were in Christ, where their identity was. They wanted their young leaders to know what are their strengths and what are their limitations. What are the things that they do very well, and what are the areas in their leadership that needed to be developed? So self-awareness was a second key trait or characteristic they wanted their young leaders to understand about themselves. Same idea I said earlier, is that they wanted their young leaders to be adults, to be comfortable in their own skin. But they didn't have to be all things to all people. The third thing that came in the research was that they wanted to make sure that their young leaders had a clear sense of their call. What is God's call on their life? In other words, if God's call on their life was to be an accountant, they didn't want the accountant to be a church planner. If God's call on their life was to work with young people, they didn't want to put them in a place where they're working with senior citizens. See, what happens oftentimes in our young leaders, we have all of these needs, all these gaps in our ministry, and we want to fill those gaps with a body. But oftentimes that person that we put in that position is not the right person. So fit, call, vision becomes a key characteristic that our leaders want the young leaders to understand.
Just clarifying, so this need for vision was it was a feature which was sought by the young leader, by the leaders, or it was the feature of the need to talk into the job market?
No, the question was, was this a need or an interest of the young leaders or the seasoned leaders, the senior leaders? And this is what the senior leaders wanted in their staff. When they were developing a young person, they wanted this young person to have in their life a sense that God had called them to this ministry. Because they did not want someone who felt like they should be doing church planting when they were being called to do youth ministry. These are all Christian leaders, yes. These are Christian leaders of Christian organizations. Yes. Yep. Yeah, Christian leaders of Christian organizations. Finally, the last characteristic that they wanted to make sure that these Christian leaders of Christian organizations wanted in their young leaders was a sense of integrity, a character. Again, this idea that my behavior and my belief were aligned. You know, unfortunately, we live in a world where we create cylinders around our life. We create barriers between our home life and our church life and our work life and maybe our recreational life. You know, I think we've had, in our country, we've had people in leadership who unfortunately separate those. I'm trying to be politically kind about this. We had a president a few years ago who was immoral with one of his aides, and when he was confronted with this immorality, he said in public, he said that how I govern and what I do in my personal life are not connected. I can behave any way I want, essentially in my personal life, but it has no bearing on how I govern as president. And I think that was really a seminal moment in American life, because I think essentially what the leader of our country said and the leader of the free world said, that I have separate lives and how I live within each of those lives don't connect. And I was really sad when I read that comment that he made. But leaders want young leaders who understand integrity and character, who live out their faith as salt and light. There's a connection between what they say, how they behave. The next question I asked them then was, so if these are the four characteristics that you want developed in your young leaders, how do you go about doing that? What is the methodology? In other words, how do we do leadership development? And in interviewing these 30 leaders, here's what they said. The first thing that we needed to do to develop young leaders is to build a community of trust. To build a community of trust where young leaders would have an opportunity to share their ideas, share their feelings, share their insecurities, share their feelings about God's call in their life and what they're doing with their lives and all the fears that go with being a young person. And building a community of trust allowed these young leaders to feel safe, a place where they could talk and to engage one another and engage senior leadership in conversations around the things that they're most concerned with. Second thing they said methodologically was that young leaders and senior leaders needed to be in a constant state of dialogue, in constant conversation. The way they did this was, they said the best way for us to teach leadership is to model leadership. In other words, leadership is probably more caught than taught. And what this group would do, these senior leaders, they would take their young leaders out to coffee, out to breakfast, out to lunch. They would invite them into their lives so they could actually see the senior leadership living out their roles as leaders. One of the interesting stories that came out in one of the conversations I had with a senior leader was that they would often invite young people into their home for dinner. And they would cook with them. And they would have these young leaders play with their children. And they would take walks together in the evening. And they would do things so that there was a constant contact. There was a constant state of dialogue, constant conversation taking place between the senior leaders and the younger leaders. The third thing that came out in my research was that there was an importance of continuing education. This idea that leadership is not something that is static or is episodic. In other words, leadership is not something that you do at a seminar like this. That leadership was a continuing experience. That leadership, because of this 187 million possibilities on Google, was something that you do all the time, that you teach leadership every day. It was a continuing experience, a continuing education. And finally, the last thing that they mentioned, or actually the second to last thing, was they created very specific opportunities to spend time with their mentors. So it was not only at dinners and coffees and walks in the park, but they would schedule in time, the senior leaders with the younger leaders, to teach and to instruct and to encourage and to motivate and to mentor. And finally, the last thing, experiential learning. This was kind of an interesting part of my research that came out. Most of us who are in senior leadership oftentimes are hesitant to give responsibility to young leaders. And why is that? Because what if they fail? What if it doesn't go the way that you think it's going to go? So what you do is you hold back. And this group of senior leaders told me, that may be the case. We may be putting a young leader in a place where they may make a mistake, they may fail, but it's better to try and to fail than not to try at all. So these senior leaders said, we want to put our young leaders in a place where they have experiences. They experience what it's like to be in a senior leadership role. And if they fail, if they make a mistake, well, it's a learning experience. Something to be cataloged, something to remember, and something to build on. And there's all sorts of research and data on experiential learning. It's actually an area of education in our country we spend a lot of time on. There's a guy in Chicago who has come up with sort of this philosophy of education, which is to say that when we experience something that we don't quite understand, in other words, you're in a position of leadership and an event takes place and you can't quite understand it, and you're here and this experience is here, what you do is you seek to bring these two, your understanding and this experience, into equilibrium. And that's what learning, experiential learning, is really about, bringing what are called disequilibrating experiences with your own experience of bringing those into equilibrium. And that's it's an educational philosophy that I think has great merit. But it's this idea that I put myself in a place where I need to, in a sense, fail in order to learn. I need to put myself in a place where I need to appropriate God's grace in a way that I would not normally be able to do that. And so in bringing these things into balance, I learn how to grow as a leader.
And we have to put our young people at a place where they are experiencing leadership, even if they fail, even if they struggle, even if they don't measure up to what your expectation is. Because in that experience, you can build a new generation of leaders. The next question, the third question I asked then was, what do young leaders report as causes for their shifts in thinking about leadership? So if we live in a culture where the tallest blade of grass gets cut first, how do we help our young leaders grow? What do they report as being significant experiences that shift their thinking about what it means to lead? They said three things. They said, first and foremost, my young people said, now here, I'm making a shift now. The first questions I asked to senior leaders, and now I went to 30 young leaders, and I said, your understanding of leadership has changed. You are now in a place where you want to ascend to some level of leadership. What changed for you? How did your understanding of leadership change from the tallest blade of grass being cut first to now wanting to assume roles of leadership? And here's what they reported. First of all, they said, my understanding of leadership changed when I spent time with those who led me. My leadership changed, my understanding of leadership changed by the fact that I spent time with people in senior leadership. The senior leaders cared about me. They cared about who I am. And the more time that they spent with senior leaders, the more leadership became not a frightening experience, but rather an experience that they wanted to ascend to. The second thing that had the biggest influence on their change of understanding leadership was the integrity they saw lived out in the life of the senior leader. You see all these themes just keep popping up? Belief, behavior. And it happens over and over. This research is so interesting to me. I got volumes of data on this, of actual interviews that I did. In fact, I should probably read a few to you. But over and over and over, young leaders said, my understanding of leadership changed when I saw the integrity of senior leadership. You know, we battle cynicism in our country. And I'm sure you all battle it in your countries. And why are we cynical? Because our leaders live one thing and confess something totally different. And that disharmony in their integrity is the root of cynicism, seems to me. And finally, the last thing that young leaders reported as the reason for a shift in their understanding of leadership is the idea of being a servant. Again, most people thought, you know, most of the young people would have reported earlier that I'm not a leader like Joshua. I didn't have this warrior mentality. I wasn't clear on my call. I was not sure that I was exactly all that a Joshua was. And so therefore I probably couldn't lead in the same fashion. But when they began to understand that leadership is more about serving than dictating, they said, this is something I can do. I actually can be a leader even if I'm a leader like her. That I didn't have to be a warrior. That in fact, if I just hold Moses' hands in the air and the Israelite army overcomes the Amalekites, I'm actually doing what God's called me to do. That I'm serving even though I'm not leading in the warrior fashion. So those are the three things that they said. These are the three things that shifted their understanding of leadership. This is where they said, you know, I can do this. When I spend time with a leader and understand that philosophy of leadership, when I see the integrity that is demonstrated by senior leaders, and then when I understand that leadership is more about serving than it is about dictating, this is something I can do. The greatest challenge we have in our organizations, in fact, I would say it's one of the greatest challenges we have in our own families, is how do we pass our faith down from generation to generation? I've got 5 children. You know, and my wife and I, we spent the last 30 years raising our kids hopefully in the faith that we embrace. And that same idea is true in organizations. How do you pass down this, you know, your experiences and your philosophy and your philosophy of ministry from one generation to the next? It's a monumental challenge. But as we need to pass our faith down from generation to generation, we also need to make sure that we're training a new generation of leaders to lead in our organizations. Because if we don't, it dies with us. It dies out in a generation. And is that really what God's called us to do? Perhaps. But I don't think so. Finally, the last question I asked, and this is kind of a summary, a little bit of what we talked about yesterday, but leadership development is most effective when leaders lead by example. And as such, great caution needs to be exercised in our lives as leaders. We need to care for our own souls. Because if we don't, we are going to end up in this disconnect between belief and behavior. So how do we do that? Well, how do you continue to grow as a leader? It seems to me that you need to read about leadership. You need to study leadership. There are these 187 million possible Google hits on leadership. Can't read them all, but you get to pick out some. You've got to become a student of leadership. If you want to lead, if you want to pass down your leadership to a second generation, you must become a student of leadership. Remember, I said this yesterday. Leadership is like any other social science. It's like, you know, psychology, anthropology, sociology, theology. Leadership development is a social science with volumes of data and research that has given us a great sense of what is required of leadership to be effective. You must become familiar with that research literature. Second thing is there's an ethic of leadership. You know, sometimes we think that if it's things that are either legal or illegal, we either obey the law or we break the law, but there's this whole area in between called ethics. And you must have an ethical standard in leadership. Just because it's not illegal doesn't make it right. You have to evaluate. You know, you have to make an assessment of not only yourself, but also your organization. You know, I try to take a couple of days every quarter to sort of make a self-evaluation. You know, what am I doing with my time? How am I spending my time? What's my relationship with my wife? What's my relationship with my children? What's my relationship with those people I work with? I try to do a sort of constant evaluation. You know, how am I doing? And then we on Wednesday mornings, we have a small group. We actually meet for breakfast, and we meet at 7 o'clock in the morning. And it's an important time for me because it's a place where I can be myself. And I ask my small group, how am I doing? What am I doing? Have I said things that are inappropriate? Have you noticed a character flaw in me? And I let my colleagues, my friends, sort of make an evaluation of me. We have to increase the opportunities for our young leaders to lead. This is back to the whole idea of experiential learning. We need to place our young leaders in roles of leadership even when they're not ready. Now, I know that sounds it's sort of counterintuitive. You say, you know, what we do is important. The mission that we're on is critical. Lives are at stake. Well, that may be, but we still have to put our young leaders in a place where they have to lead. And finally, you know, the leadership is something that historically, up until the last 10 years, has really not been taught in our formal educational institutions, but now leadership is being taught at the university level. And in our country now, almost every Christian school teaches courses in leadership. And so I would say to you all, I'm not sure that's happening here in Europe or not, but to the extent that you can have your young leaders continue to grow in their understanding of the theory and the research behind leadership, you need to put them in that place. Because we really have got to get our minds around this. If we don't, I'm afraid that our churches and our nonprofit organizations, our businesses, they'll collapse if we don't have healthy leaders. You know, I think I said this yesterday. You know, that as I've had the experience in churches in our community, the issues that we deal with in churches are not very often theological. Every so often there's a theological disagreement. you know, should women teach men or not? Okay, well, that's fine. Maybe some believe they should, maybe some believe they shouldn't. And churches split on that. That's a theological question. But the way in which we deal with morality in the church, the way in which we deal with disagreement, the way we deal with sin, we don't debate whether something's sinful or not, but the way in which we deal with it is a leadership issue. And so we need to get ourselves at a place where we are good leaders, that we have a good, sound theology of leadership. There's a book I would recommend that you read called In the Name of Jesus. It was written by a Catholic priest by the name of Henry Nouwen. I don't know if that's a name that's familiar to you. Henry Nouwen.
It's on the book table.
Oh, it's on the book table? Okay. I think it's on my... It might be on my bibliography there, too. Henry Nouwen. And he wrote a book called In the Name of Jesus. And I think that's as good a book as I've ever read on a theology of leadership. It's the very best. And I would highly recommend that. I think leadership starts with a theology of leadership. You know, the word theology is the study of who God is. Well, the theology of leadership is the study of who God is in the course of leadership. And Henry Nouwen does a great job of developing a theology of leadership that I think could actually be a bedrock for you in terms of building your own philosophy of leadership. So, or just questions in general on leadership.
I can't help noticing that in the point you make in the outline, you really stress the primacy of character over qualities, which is a real contrast to the way the world recruits and trains young leaders. We look at qualities first, regardless of the character.
Mm-hmm.
None of these things that from your survey really indicate that they look first at qualities.
Yeah.
Could you talk about the balance between the two, character and quality in raising up leaders?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think integrity is a characteristic. I think it's something that we need to certainly develop. But boy, my experience is that we're
Can you comment on the relationship between recruiting or training young leaders with character,
mm-hmm.
vis-a-vis young leaders' character vis-a-vis qualities?
Other qualities besides integrity, or is that what you're saying?
Yeah, just the character versus the quality. You know, a person can have great skills.
Yep.
And have no character. A person can have great character.
Right.
And be really low on the qualities.
Yeah.
You need.
Yep. Yeah. There. Yeah. The question was this sort of this connection between doing skill development in leadership versus the question of character and integrity. And what we often do, and this, I don't know, what's your name?
Avi.
Avi's right. You know, oftentimes what we do when we teach leadership, we teach skills. You need to be a good visionary. You need to be a good organizer. You need to be a good communicator. And we do that often at the expense of really getting at the very core issue, which is who am I in terms of my character and integrity? Do my values align with my behaviors? And I think it's a grave error when we start with skills. I think we start with character. Character is where it begins. I would rather have a man of, or woman of character on my team than a man who has all of these warrior-like or charismatic characteristics or skills. Because the person of character is someone I can trust. If I can't trust you, I can't put you in a role of leadership.
Character trumps skills every
time. Always.
The higher up you go, especially.
Always. Always. Character always trumps skills. Because I tell you what, this is interesting to me. You can teach leadership skills. I'm not sure you can teach character. I'm not sure. I mean, I mean, we can talk about character, we can define it, but I'm not sure you can teach it.
The Bible says that when recruiting, character is such a high thing because it can cause the most damage. somebody makes an error in character, it can actually hurt the whole organization. And also that he says that character is already in the person, like you said. It's not something that's going to super develop in any role, but the skills may develop in the role.
Right. I've thought about this. That's a great question. You know, I think about this a lot. As we hire people and as I work with students, and I'm asking this question all the time about character. What is their character? To what extent do they live out their confession? Because skill sets, I can give you a book and I can have you read a book and you can read all the skills necessary to be an effective leader. But what about character? How do you develop that?
But don't you think character can be developed? I mean, the word maybe not taught, but developed. And that's kind of the process of discipleship.
Yes.
And that's what we as good Christian leaders do, is that we are, you know, developing character. I think you can do that. Mm-hmm. I think you can develop character in people. And that comes with that honest relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It comes with somebody speaking the truth in love to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it can be developed, but it's hard. But
yeah.
The person has to want character.
Right, exactly.
You can't develop character.
Exactly. Exactly. And that might be the distinction right there. Is you can develop it, but if you're a person who struggles with it or doesn't want it, I'm not sure that you can implant that in somebody.
So it begins in childhood.
Does begin.
Child,
yeah.
And then it carries on in terms of God and relationship between God and that person.
Mm-hmm.
Or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Now, a small question. Maybe you said it already, and maybe everybody else here understands it, but I'd like to have a comment on this headline, tallest blade of grass is cut first.
Yes. that is a Czech proverb. And the idea is that if you ascend to leadership, if you find yourself in a place where you are leading, that you will be cut off. You will be dismantled. You will not be allowed to lead. By those around you. Do we have any Czech brothers, sisters here? Maybe you could explain it better than I could.
I'm Polish, but I think I understand what it means. If you are, we're all the same, we're all good, we're all cool friends. But then if you start leading us,
yes,
we start not liking you.
Okay.
Because you are now, you have more power, so we will cut you off from our circles, you know, that kind of concept.
Yeah, it comes from the idea that you know, people in leadership oftentimes abuse those around them. And so what we do is we cut you off so that you don't abuse us. Nick?
Actually, I'm Macedonian from Bulgaria, and we were talking with my wife a few days ago. What is the difference between people from my ethnicity or culture and the rest of Europe? And she says, one thing no any other nation has, to kill their well-proven leaders. And this is interesting, because this is your observation, and I agree.
Mm-hmm.
The only nation which has so much jealousy, and when the leader go up, and it's well recognized outside, they try to kill him. Mm-hmm. I mean, not physically, with gossip, with all other things, but they just want it. And I agree with this illustration, with cutting the grass which is going up.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in Czech Republic, because they are Slavs, maybe it's the same. I don't know.
I think it's connected with the history that in Poland for the last 200 years, whoever was above you was an occupant, or a German, or Russian, or a feminist. So people don't like leaders. No, it's changing in Poland. It's better and better, but I don't know about Czech Republic and other countries.
Yeah.
Well, Grace's explanation, my wife's explanation, is it's from the time of Alexander the Great. This was Athens, which was developed at that time.
And I think that it's also some idea of communism, that we are all equal. Somebody isn't equal, it is wrong, and it is him to put money.
Yep, yep. Make everybody the same.
During communism was that,
yep.
We are all equal, but
some will be more equal.
Yeah, exactly.
There was an American man who was the manager of a Lucent technology firm in northern Poland.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to motivate his workers and ask them to be creative and everything. He could not do it because even creativity to them was rising above, and they were feeling that he couldn't give them enough benefit for them to actually do it, even more salary or anything like that.
Yep. Yep. And again, imagine a church or an organization without a leader. What would happen?
Doesn't know where to go.
It's chaos. Mm-hmm. It's chaos. And so if we have a culture where we don't value leadership, our institutions will fall apart.
So we come to a question, except in the Polish context. Most churches are led by one pastor, mm-hmm. one pastor only. He does everything.
Yep.
So it's like a circle. He would like the church to grow, but he does not give he doesn't delegate.
Yep.
How could we, influence those pastors and in our country so they are open, how do they get open? Do they have to, die and the next generation comes?
Yeah.
Because sometimes it seems like that.
Yeah.
They cut them off.
Yeah.
You fail. Well, you take them here to teach them about this.
Right.
Yeah. Nick, did you want to say something?
Well, last evening during the interview from the platform, this guy from, was he from Latvia? He gave how you can change.
Yeah. Start with 14-year-olds? Is that what you mean?
No, if you say you build up new leaders and then replace the old leaders.
Yeah.
David, if I look at your research, look at the first section, the question to the senior leaders.
Yep.
So senior leaders, if I read it well, they are looking for after people who have a clear sense of vision, who are servants in their heart, who have integrity, and on the other hand, the juniors are looking for a leader who has integrity, who are servant in their heart, and who spend a lot of time with them.
Yeah.
So is it not the case that they are all? So I'm missing here something.
Okay.
And maybe it is Jesus. I'm not sure. Well, I'm not sure.
Rewind the tape.
So this model doesn't really mention Jesus.
Yeah.
So there was no mention of Jesus or Christ.
Sure.
There is a senior group looking for character.
Yep.
They either find it or they don't. The junior group, they are seeking for character, and either they find it or they don't. But it's very, very often the case that the one generation blames the other.
This is just a brilliant comment that he made. It's interesting to me that what senior leaders want out of younger leaders is exactly what the younger leaders want out of the senior leaders. And the connecting point is Jesus. He is our model of these kinds of things. And it's interesting to me that as you do this, I got 190 pages of research on this whole thing, and these themes are consistent over and over and over, is that senior leaders want young people who are people, men and women of integrity and servants and kind of know the destination that they're on. But the young leaders are saying, well, we want to look up to leaders who are people of integrity and have direction and know how to love and care for us. And I find this to be, and this is true not only in Europe, but it's true everywhere. And so why is it that we're unable to bring those two together? Well, part of it could, in fact, because that Christ is not at the center of our identity as leaders. Then maybe what we do is we want to be something different than the model that Jesus gave us. And so we are people of integrity, and we are more dictatorial and authoritative, and we don't serve, and we don't love, and we don't care for people, and we don't spend time with them. And leadership then is ineffective.
I think
important part of integrity is how we deal with us and other people when we fail.
Mm-hmm.
And here, I think both Jesus and grace comes in. Mm-hmm. Because if I, as a senior leader, handle my sin and my failure, open to the younger leaders,
mm-hmm.
by going to Jesus and asking forgiveness, and go to them and asking forgiveness, then they can
yes.
see the recognition and see him as the great leader.
Yeah.
Then grace is a part of our ministry.
Absolutely. This is so interesting, what you just said. When you invite someone into your life, you actually invite them to see all parts of you, right? And invariably, none of us are going to be perfect. So when I invite someone into my life, they see all the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so I'm constantly seeking forgiveness and grace and mercy from people I'm around because I do stupid things all the time. But that's part of this authenticity. It's part of the integrity of living out your faith as salt and light, realizing that you're not perfect, that you say things that perhaps are inappropriate or you think things are wrong, and you have to seek forgiveness from your brother or from your sister. That's part of inviting someone into your life. It's part of this experience of doing leadership development together. It's great.
What's happening when young people grow up as a leader in a church? And after that, he tried to be a leader in another organization to extend his leadership out from the church. But the church said, we grow you up, we need you here, we want to serve you here. And your energy has to be in the church.
Yeah, repeat that question one more time, or say it slightly different.
Yeah. When a leader grow up in the church, and a young people grow up as a leader in the church, and after that he tried to extend his leadership out of the church. What's happened because the church tells him, we grow you up, we need to serve in the church, not outside. What's happened then?
Is that an experience that anyone has had? You've had the same experience?
Yes, similar.
In what way?
Church is jealous that one cannot see the opportunity to use the gifted man to go and extend it. Can be in business life, in political life, in science, mm-hmm. in other areas. They just want to keep him in their isolated
yep.
ghetto.
Yep.
And to own him only for that area in the church.
Which again is why
we're sorry situation, but it is.
Oh yeah, and that's why we are so cynical about leadership, because you know as he just said, is, you know, we grow up in the church and the church wants to keep us in, doesn't develop us, or if they develop us, it's develop us only for our church, and then you want to go out and follow God's call in your life, and there's tension, right? There's difficulty in that. And that's why we need to change. We need to change that system. Part of being a servant leader is trying to say, how can I help you do what God's called you to do? That's what servant leadership is. How do I help you do what God's called you to do? Not how do I help you do what I want you to do for me, but how do I help you do what God's called you to do? That's what a servant leader does. Good. Well, that's about it, I think, for our time.
We want to thank you, David, for today's contribution, but also yesterday's contribution. And I think many of us are going to use the opportunity to write to this email.
Good. Great.